So guys, good afternoon. So we're going to do the tutorial on planning graph-based reachability heuristics. Dan Bryce and I will do sort of tag team approach for this, and we'll explain to you where, what, who does what. The first thing is I think the slides are probably available. All of you probably have the slides that we put in the tutorial itself. One other thing is there is a paper associated with the tutorial that's available at this web page. I don't know where, was that part of the tutorial materials they got?
No.
I don't think so. Okay. So you could actually also, if you go to this URL, you'll get the paper, which is sort of a survey paper on this stuff. So that's an extra resource for you. Okay. One thing before I go forward is stop me and stop Dan if ever you have any questions. We have a lot of time. We have 4 hours, I believe, or 3.5 hours. In fact, we decided that we would rather go slightly deeper into a couple of things so that all of you get them rather than just go breakfast on many, many topics. So please, if you are lost, I don't know, it's one of the things in a tutorial of this kind is different people have very different backgrounds. Some of you probably know everything that I might be able to tell you, and some of you don't know any of it. And so just if you are lost, you know, try to stop me and ask questions. Okay. So let's start at the beginning. This was a picture of the relative performance of planners taken not too long back, actually. It's about 1992 time frame, I think. This is from, you know, it's a state-of-the-art performance of planners, and, you know, the way you could see that clearly this was made by whoever whose performance is this, because, you know, you obviously do not put a picture where you're doing badly. And obviously the, you know, they're all exponential anyway, and they're pretty badly exponential. It's just that compared to these two losers, we are slightly better off. More importantly, the CPU time here is in seconds, and this is number of rockets in a reasonably simplistic rocket problem where you have multiple rockets on the Earth and you need to take packages to the moon, something of that kind. And you'll notice that the number of goals is about 4, all hell breaks loose, and you know, you start going stratospherically in terms of amount of time spent. Okay, it's just a question of who was less of a loser than who else. And then, so we had a lot of fun. I think some of you weren't born yet at that time. We had a lot of fun writing all these great papers, you know, that we could do better than you. Things were going well, and we were able to, the state of the art essentially was we could synthesize about 6 to 10 action plans in under minutes, you know. Under minutes is very important, so you just basically see whatever else, whatever you can do within minutes, and that's the state of the art. And the main difference basically is this is from, I think, 2 years back. The IPC, the International Planning Competition, a chart from there. This was from a domain called airport domain, where essentially the issue is deconflicting multiple flights which are trying to take off from limited runway space. And they had, I think, the largest domain, that largest problem they had in that case was able to more or less reasonably model Munich airport operations. This is the claim at any rate. The problem itself is, I looked at the PDDL file. PDDL, by the way, is the language in which the problems are written. We'll talk about it in a minute. But, you know, it's like close to 1,000 lines, as far as I remember, in some of these problems. It's just a large amount of specification of the flights and the runway operations. We were able to solve these, and there are multiple different planners. Each of them have different, lots and lots of nice names, and The number of, these are essentially the number of tasks, and I believe the number of actions is actually kind of multiple of that. So you can essentially generate plans of hundreds of steps in under the same number of minutes. Okay. So, and you know, to some extent actually this is mind-boggling because if you remember your simple basic search, right, you're talking about when you have these kind of long plans, you are talking about D power D amount of search, and that's, you know, huge amounts of spaces, hugely large spaces, and you're able to do plan synthesis in these kinds of domains with this, in this kind of problem sizes. To me, I think the big difference in the last 10-15 years is this sort of a revolutionary scale-up in the planner performance. Okay, before 90s, people were interested in all sorts of expressive planning. We still continue to be interested in all sorts of expressive planning. The difference was when we couldn't actually stack two blocks on top of each other under minutes, we were also considering what would happen when you throw in uncertainty, time, everything. And so every time you add one more of these expressiveness issues, you would reduce your performance further. And so it was actually quite important that we figured out how to control search. And to a large extent, maybe we overdid it in the last 10 years, to a large extent, the big thing has been how to improve search. Okay, and the take that we will, I mean, the point I'll try to make and we try to make in this tutorial is that there are a, you know, there are several possible reasons, but one is very important, which is this idea of reachability heuristics that large number of planners wind up using. And these heuristics, it's sort of, you know, if you're thinking of improving a search algorithm, you need to provide heuristic information. And domain-independent heuristics, how do you compute these heuristics and how did they get used in the planners so that they could go from, you know, this sort of a qualitative change in the performance, okay? So the point then is that we will talk a lot about what sort of reachability heuristics were used, and in particular, there's a specific kind of family of reachability heuristics called planning graph-based reachability heuristics. That's what we'll talk about a lot. And so this is hopefully a sort of a motivation as to why planning graph-based reachability heuristics are interesting. The mechanics of this tutorial are that there would be about 1.5 hours between now and the coffee break. And I would talk during that time about classical planning, cost-based planning, and partial satisfaction planning. These are different problems. For all these problems, how do we actually use reachability heuristics? You know, how do the heuristics change for the various types of these problems? And then we'll have a break, and when we come back, Dan Bryce will talk about reachability heuristics for non-deterministic and stochastic planning. And we will, he'll also spend some time on the main topic that he'll be talking about is probabilistic and non-deterministic planning and how do you use reachability heuristics for that. And then we'll spend some time on how the same sort of heuristics, how we can also handle resources and temporal planning. Again, the idea is to use a general reachability analysis but for a variety of planning problems. And in doing so, we will see some patterns as to how the same planning graph structure can be actually co-opted to do these variety of different problems. Okay. And then we will have the last half hour to wrap up, sort of try to summarize the various things we have done. You'll notice that the resources and temporal planning, we would probably wind up going more breadth first there, just because I think the two things that we want to make sure that you'll get are the deterministic, cost-based, and the classical planning scenarios, and stochastic and non-deterministic planning scenarios. We'll spend a lot more time on that, and then we'll spend slightly less time on the other one. However, there are slides as well as the description in the paper refers to all the problems. Okay. So we will talk about classical planning and how to use heuristics, the planning graph-based heuristics. We need some example domain that we can use our discussion, to base our discussion on. and we're going to use this rover domain. So this is the definition of the domain used basically in all these planning domains. You give the description of the actions in terms of preconditions and effects of those actions, and a problem is specified in terms of the initial state and the goal state that you want to get to. Okay, so in this particular case, the rover has a drive action, a communicate action, and a sample action. And for example, the drive, it has a precondition that it's in X, and the effect is that it will go to Y and it no longer is in X. So this is for driving from X to Y. Okay. And similarly, communicate, if you have the data, then you can communicate the data. And similarly, the sample, if you are at X and the data is available at X, then you will have the data, so you have collected it. That's the very simple action description. And in fact, one of the things we'll do is as we go from, so this is the simplest classical planning variant of this rover problem. We can add times on it, you can add costs on it, you can add non-deterministic effects on it, and so on. In fact, we will actually try to use variations of the same domain for all the problems. For all the types of problems. So this is the simplest version that we're going to look at right now. And so in the, and the specific problem we will look at for the example, for the classical planning part, is you are, so the rover is at alpha, there is soil at alpha, rock at beta, and there's an image at gamma, and your goal is to communicate information about all three. Okay, so what that would involve is going to the three places and you know, having the data and communicating. That's it. It's a very simple problem. Okay, so keep that in the back of your head while we go forward. Okay, now the simplest part of the difficulty of this tutorial is we are talking about how to improve performance of various types of planners. Okay, so to some extent, if you don't actually know any of these planning algorithms, you are also trying to learn what these planning algorithms are and how to improve them at the same time. Okay, I have to make reasonable assumptions and assume that you would know at least some of the general, simple planning algorithms. But if you are lost, please stop us. Okay, if for example the entire room is lost as soon as I said forward search or projection, then yeah, we could have a nice different tutorial. But you know, it still beats the heck out of actually everybody sleeping. So anyway, so we will assume that we will be doing, so the simplest type of planning that everybody understands is this notion of projection, the progression planning, okay? In progression planning, what do? You start from the state you are in, consider all the actions you can do in that state, consider all the states you can get to, and keep doing this projection. Okay, and now you stop as soon as you reach a state that actually has all the goals in it. Okay, now so you could actually think of this picture as the search tree that's developed, and as soon as you reach a node in the search tree where your goals are satisfied, you stop. This is your simple progression search. Now the trick, of course, in progression search is, you know, at any time you have a fringe of this tree and you have a bunch of states, and you can expand these states to get new world states. Which ones would you rather expand? And if you go breadth first, you die. Okay. So the real question is, given a bunch of child states, descendant states during the search, which of these states are more promising? Okay. This is the question. This is, in some sense, what the heuristic is going to try and answer for you. And what you're interested in figuring out is if you have this fringe, for each of these states, if I can figure out how far are they from the goal state, then that's useful information. Again, this is, you know, based AI 101, but we're just repeating it here. And so you need the distance from those states to the goal state. Now, if you get exact distances, you're very happy. If you get some approximations, you're still okay. But that's really ultimately what you're interested in computing. Okay. So now I want to talk about this issue of do you have a pen here in there? Okay. If I have the nodes on the fringe, for each of the nodes on the fringe, I'm trying to figure out how far are they from the goal state. Okay. I will suggest the following dumb idea. Okay, please just bear with me before I get you to something more interesting. Which is, for each of these nodes on the fringe, do this projection tree from each of those nodes on the fringe until you reach the goal state for each of them. And when you reach the goal state, you know the exact distance from each of those nodes on the fringe, and then you know how far each of them are from the goal node, and then you pick the one which is the closest. And in fact, if you want to do A star search, you already have the cost to the goal, the number of steps to the node on the fringe, and then you also have the true go distance, and you have F value, and you're happy. Okay? So I'm asking you to look at this picture now under a different light. I thought of this picture as just this is what is going on in terms of actually doing the search at the base level. But I can also say that if I know how to project, right, I can use this projection algorithm directly to also compute the exact distances of the nodes on the fringe to how far are they from the goal node. Okay? This is a dumb idea. Why? Because you are, instead of solving one simple problem, you are solving many, many planning problems. You're finding optimal plans for every node on the fringe. However, so let's play with this idea right now. So if we have this notion of projection, then you'll get numbers. Maybe there is a way you can do approximate projection. The full projection is going to be as costly as planning itself. Is there a way you could do approximate projection? Okay, so this is interesting because ultimately you'll see that all the reachability heuristics find approximate approximate projection. They do a sort of approximate projection. And so I would show you a data structure that many of you probably know as planning graph. And I say that planning graph is really trying to compute this tree except in approximation of this. Okay? So if you were starting from this initial state, and if you were to compute a planning graph, how many of you have not heard of planning graph? Okay, so all of you know planning graph. So if you basically compute the planning graph, it would look something like this. It looks ugly. You know, nobody really wants to write planning graphs on paper. The difference in essence is you are considering, so here for example, drive, there are three drive actions, and you consider all, and they're all in different branches in the projection tree. What you're doing in the planning graph is you're acting as if all of them can be done in parallel. Okay, so you're ignoring interactions between the actions and saying, let's try to do all of them together in parallel. Okay, and then if you do this, then this is some, instead of different states here, I have what's called a proposition list. Think of the proposition list there as sort of a union over these states. Okay, and then you have more actions here, and then the state. Now, if you put this planning graph on top of this projection tree, it's clear that essentially the states are connected to the proposition list. A union of states is proposition list. Okay, so that's the general connection between these two structures. Now, so you can think of the planning graph as an envelope of a progression tree. However, it's relaxed. Why is it relaxed? So here's the tricky question. How long does it take to compute this structure? You know, it's exponential time. How long does it take to compute the top level structure? It better not be exponential time, otherwise it's not going to be a good basis for heuristics. In fact, it turns out it's polynomial time. Okay? Now why? Why is that cheaper than this? It looks as if everything here is there. However, not everything here is there. In fact, these two structures have the following interesting connection, that if you take the proposition list here, right, and if I find, for example, that a particular literal, a particular fluent value doesn't exist here. So, for example, a particular state variable equal to true doesn't exist here. Then you can be sure that there is no state here where that state variable is true. On the other hand, if you have something true here, that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a state here where something, that particular thing is true. What's more interesting is if you have two things true in the proposition list, there may not be a single state here where two things are true together. It's possible that one of them is true in state one, another is true in state two, And so when you union them, it looks as if you are reaching both of them. So in fact, it's actually possible to have proposition lists, in fact, where P and not P are present in the proposition list. And clearly, there is no world state where P and not P would be true. And that's because P was true in some state, not P was true in another state, and you just union them and so you had both. That's the reason why planning graph is cheaper to compute. So the useful information it does give is in sort of a negative sense. So if something is not there in a proposition list of level K, that means you couldn't reach a state where that fact would be true in K level. If it is there, that doesn't mean that you can definitely reach it in K level. Okay? So you think of planning graph essentially as an optimistic projection algorithm. And you can make this projection more and more closer to the true projection by spending more and more time. And as you increase the accuracy of projection, you wind up getting more and more informed heuristics, but you're also increasing the cost of computing the heuristic. And in general, if you just go back to your A-star search fundamentals, you know that it's not at all clear upfront as to where the best trade-off would be in terms of how much time you should spend in computing the heuristic versus how accurate, I mean, the accuracy versus computation time. Okay. One of the interesting things is if somebody told you that you should use this kind of planning graph heuristics to compute how far something is from the world state and use that as a heuristic information to drive a projection or a forward search algorithm, until you actually do it and see that it actually does better, you wouldn't believe it. And you're not alone, because most community never actually considered this kind of ideas. Before we considered this sort of reachability information, the simplest sort of ideas that were considered was set difference heuristics. So if you have a goal, if you have a set of goals, and you have a state, and you want to see how far is this state from this goal state, you take the set difference between the goal state and the current state. Cheap to compute. And unfortunately, you get what you pay for in terms of search control. Okay? So in a way, you're actually spending more time computing the heuristic, and you know, empirically, we all see that it actually performs much better. Okay. So this, in some sense, is the background of why projection is connected to planning graph heuristic. Now, the planning graph data structure. Now what we'll do is look at some specific ways of picking up this heuristic information. I mean, in some sense, I already told you that if something is present in level K, then you know that the plan for reaching that should be at least K. Okay? Okay, so I would use, so it turns out that there are, having started from this simple insight, there are multiple ways you can, you know, kind of massage this information. The simplest idea is a level of a set of literals in the planning graph data structure. Okay, so we call these level-based heuristics. So, for example, if these are the goals, you remember for our simple problem, you want to be able to communicate image, communicate rock, and communicate soil. Now, here is a level, in fact, here is the first level where they're all present. Since you want all the goals, then this is the first level, they're all present. So I would say that the set level, I have this name called set level, the heuristic, set level heuristic gives for this, that it requires three steps to reach all those goals. So as far as set level heuristic is concerned, the heuristic cost is three. Starting from this state, you need at least three steps to go there. Okay? So that's the level-based heuristic. There is another idea called max, where you act as if you are looking for the cost of reaching a set of literals, you can look at the cost of reaching each one of them separately, okay, and then somehow do an operation on them. The set level essentially considers all of them together, the first time all of them come up together. Here you're going to consider each of them, take the level of each of the individual literals and see, you know, somehow do some operation on them. So you can add them up or take a max on them. And so in fact, if you take max, there's, for example, communication of soil occurs first in level 2, and the other two occur in level 3. If you take max of them, it's 3. Okay? Now it turns out that you can show that set level and max are actually admissible heuristics. Okay, admissible in the A star sense. That means you are never going to overestimate the cost. Yes, sir. Yes, right now they are. But we will get to a point where they are not. Okay, that's a very good point. Of course, I mean, even though it's afternoon, it's nice to know that we are not asleep. So there are set level and max are actually the same. In this case, wait for a few minutes when we'll talk about mutual exclusion and we'll see that they are not the same anymore. Okay? And here is a third idea where essentially you took the three and added them up. This is what's called the sum heuristic, and it's just saying, in this case, 2 plus 3 plus 3, 8. Okay? In all of these cases, essentially what you're doing is, this set level is taking the interactions between the goals into account, and they are looking at the first level where all of them come together. When you added them up, in some sense, you are assuming all the goals are independent. If goals are independent, and if you know how costly it is to achieve each of these, the total cost for all goals together will be sum. Now, to the extent you are making an independent assumption, and if your goals are actually independent, you are happy. If you are not independent, and they actually are positively interacting, you're still happy, but you don't get the badge of admissibility. Because when you have positive interactions between the goals, then the total cost of achieving them all together is cheaper than cost of achieving each of them separately. So you no longer get the badge of admissibility. If they're negatively interacting and you are assuming that they're independent, then you are in trouble because you get a heuristic estimate which is much lower than the true cost, and so you can actually be quite, you'll be going in the wrong direction. Okay? But here, assuming that, you know, just given this planning graph structure, you have these three different notions of, three different ideas of computing the heuristic information. And people have tried all of these. For whatever reason, it actually turns out that while this is admissible, this winds up working better in performance. So you are better off if you're just looking at the ICAP planning competition style performance where optimality guarantees are not required and the only thing that you're looking for is how many problems do you solve faster than other people, and when you do solve it, how far are you, you know, compared to your other guys who also solved it. Some heuristic winds up being better. Okay. Now, and I already said that anything based on set level is actually admissible. Okay, anything based on sum is not admissible. And it turns out that there are variations of combining them. We will see some of these as we go forward in terms of, for example, let me just point this out. Instead of summing individual goals separately, I could have done the following thing. If I have a set of goals, G1 to GN, I might say the first three are a set, which is closely interacting. The next five are a set. The next, you know, 20 are a set. And then I can try to compute set level heuristics for these subsets and add them up. So these are, so the interactions are sort of localized into subsets. And there are variations of that kind which have been tried, and, you know, sometimes they work well. In fact, this is idea called partitioning the subgoals. That can work well. But let me go into some exact, some more detailed versions of that idea. In particular, the level-based heuristics, I said, are admissible, and the sum heuristics are not particularly good, but some heuristics are making this assumption that the goals are independent. Okay? And I mentioned that if the goals are actually positively interacting, some heuristics are inadmissible, and also they are sort of misleading you to some extent because you're assuming that things are costlier than what they are really. Okay? To see that example, to see that level-based heuristic, which is admissible, can be totally off the mark in terms of computing the cost, estimating the cost correctly. Consider the following example. Here, essentially, you have, I guess, one goal, I guess, let's see, the goal G, and A gives that goal G. A has 100 preconditions. There are 100 different actions that give each of those preconditions. That's the way the domain is. I made up this domain. And so in this case, if you go by level, obviously you'll assume that G has two-step long plan. Okay? if you, if, but on the other hand, really, the cost of this plan is 100 actions here plus one action here, 101 actions. Okay? So now in this case, so the question is, can we capture these sorts of things and capture actually the structure of how the achievement is going on in the graph and use that in computing the heuristic value? Turns out that that's not too hard. What you can actually do is the following. What you want is G, right? Okay? Look for the subgraph of this planning graph. You can come by and sit in the front. You need to. There are bunches of things there. Look by and look at the subgraph of this planning graph, which ultimately supports G. Okay, so the idea would be here, you know, A is supporting G. Now, because A is in all these other vertices are in, for each of the vertex that's now in the planning in the plan, somebody should be supporting them. Okay, now this way I have computed the subgraph of this planning graph, which corresponds to, which is actually supporting the top level goal. Now this subgraph is a plan for supporting the top level goal. This plan would have worked, but for the fact that in it's a subgraph of this particular planning graph, which made the assumption that actions can be done ignoring their interaction. So if only there was no, if we did not, if we somehow took into account the negative interactions, this would have been the real plan. And in fact, just to put our things back a bit, originally this idea of planning graph data structure came as part of the graph plan algorithm. Now graph plan algorithm, essentially what it did was it would generate the planning graph, okay, and search directly on the planning graph for the plan, a subgraph of this planning graph which would correspond to a valid plan. The only thing between graph plan, the only thing that stands between what I just told you, which is just look a subgraph of this, which is a, which is supporting this top level goal, and what graph plan does, the only difference is graph plan, while computing this subgraph, checks to see if any actions that it has selected as part of this subgraph are interfering. So you could consider two actions to be statically interfering if one of them violates the preconditions and effects of the other. That's it. Okay. If you just say, okay, I have A here, and then I have these conditions, and to support them, I pick these conditions, these actions. Oh, B3 and B9 are interfering statically, so I need some other actions to support this. If you do that, and if you look for other actions, then you are graph plan. Okay? But that step changes your complexity from what to what, from polynomial to exponential, because in the other case, you are backtracking over different possible actions supporting the same goal. In this case, on the other hand, anybody who can support A, anybody who can support G, in this case A is supporting it, so I'll put it in, and then for each of its preconditions, anybody who can support them are put into the planning graph. Okay, so in this case, this subgraph is a relaxed plan, whereas the graph plan subgraph is a real plan. And to get the real plan, of course, you need to backtrack. Okay, so what we would do now, essentially, is use this relaxed plan structure itself as the basis for the heuristic. Okay, so when you actually did compute this set of plan, this subgraph, that would have given you 100 actions here plus one action here, total of 101 actions. That's the number that you wanted. Okay, so you can see why relaxed plan heuristic would work better in this kind of scenario. Okay, there's a lot of text here, but I think I just described all this stuff already with respect to that single slide. One thing that I do want to mention is this. Finding a relaxed plan is cheap. Okay? Finding an optimal relaxed plan turns out not to be cheap. Even if you ignore interactions, if you want to find the optimal relaxed plan, so the idea would then be that it's not that any of these actions are interfering with each other, it's just that they might be, for example, you might have costs to these actions, or for example, you want the relaxed plan that has the least number of actions together. In that case, you have to consider all subgraphs and see which is the best. And it turns out you can show that it can become best. Okay? So we would not find optimal relaxed plans. We'll just find a relaxed plan. You do greedy search and find the usual thing is to just do one pass and find action supporting the goals that you are looking for and stuff. Now, one nice thing, as we go forward into other types of problems, including cost-based planning and partial satisfaction planning and temporal planning and partly stochastic planning, we will see that the specific way in which you interpret the word greedy in computing the relaxed plan over the planning graph changes. Okay, so for example, you can do it greedily, but take cost information into account in computing the first relaxed plan. And that would give you more cost-sensitive heuristic information. We'll see the examples of this as we go forward. Okay, so anyway, this is just to do it on our example, to do the relaxed plan, to the relaxed plan for our problem, you identify the goal propositions, you consider, so if you have these, once you pick the goal propositions, you pick the actions for supporting them, and pick actions for supporting their preconditions all the way down, and all I'm showing is what parts of the graph will get picked up as part of the relaxed plan, which is a subgraph of this overall planning graph. And in this case, if you count the actions in that planning, that relaxed plan, there would be 8 of them, and that would be considered the cost now. Okay. Now notice that 8 is different from what you would have gotten from the set level, okay, which is 3, and let's see, what were the other ones we looked at? Sum would be the same. In this case, it turns out that sum actually winds up having the same value. Okay. These are essentially showing results of, I guess, FF's performance. FF is actually one of the first planners which used this relaxed plan heuristic directly and in the competition. And, you know, we actually do quite well if you use this sort of heuristic. Again, I want you to also understand that while you can think of relaxed plan heuristic in isolation, it's nicer to think of it as part of a family of exploiting the planning graph data structure. There is set level, there is sum, there is relaxed plan, and then there are other ways of computing relaxed plans that we will look at in a minute. Okay. As long as we have planning graphs in front of us and we are using them for computing the heuristic information, you might as well use them for other things during planning. Okay, since you have it anyway in front of you. So one idea is that actually when you're using planning graphs to compute these heuristics, the cost of actually generating the planning graph is going to be an important issue. And so you want to efficiently generate the planning graph structure. And there are ideas, even though we show you this notion of completely unfolded planning graph, if any of you who thought about it probably realize that there's a large amount of redundancy in the planning graph data structure. For example, if something comes in, it never goes out. It's tenured. The moment it comes into the planning graph data structure, if a literal is true in level 4, it will then be true in 5, 6, 7, 8, all the way till infinite. Okay? So there is a lot of redundancy in the structure, and so in fact, you can remember that the entire planning graph structure as a bi-level structure, one level corresponding to the first level at which each of the propositions came in, and another corresponding to first level at which each of the actions came in. And if you have those two bits of information, you have all that you need about planning graph, which is much cheaper in terms of memory and so on. Okay. The other interesting thing about using planning graphs as part of the heuristics is that actually there is this issue of how far must you grow the planning graph, which I did not go into detail. I just basically said if you have the planning graph, then you can start using information from that to compute the heuristic graph. Okay. The question is, how far do you extend the planning graph? Okay. One simple idea for the kind of planning graph that we have looked at till now is keep extending it until there is no difference between two consecutive proposition lists. That's basically called level of condition. And this, you know, it is guaranteed to happen because, you know, once something comes in, it will never go out. So you are monotonically increasing the proposition list size, and there are only so many fluents in the domain. So at some point of time, you would have covered all of them, and sometimes actually there are certain fluents which can't be reached, in which case two consecutive proposition lists would both have not changed from each other, so you can stop there. This is the first idea you have. Now it turns out that suppose I'm lazy, I don't want to do it to level off. Okay, I have given myself a number, a magic number, 7, And then I will only extend the planning graph up to level 7. Fine with me. Okay? Because you're using it for heuristic. Okay? If you are looking for a set of goals and they don't appear by level 7, you know that their cost is at least 8. Which is better than your friend who thinks they're all zero cost. Okay? So, the advantage of thinking of planning graph as part of the heuristic computation is you can be as lazy or as studious as you want. You can go all the way to level up, or you can go to the first level where the top level goals come into the planning graph proposition list and stop after that. Or you can say, you know, my limit is 7. I go 7 levels. That's it. Any of them are fine. Okay? So this is actually turns out to be an important thing, because if you are using the planning graph as the basis for directly computing the plan the way graph plan does, you don't have this kind of flexibility. Okay? But here you're using it as a heuristic. So heuristics can be wrong. You know, the worst that can happen is, you know, if you're a planner, the worst thing that can happen to you is you give a plan out that's incorrect. Okay, most planners don't come back at all. So if you don't come back, nobody cares. But if you say, I'm done and here is a plan and it's not a plan, you know, everybody laughs at you. Okay, and even planners have feelings. So the most important thing you want to do is to avoid unsound planners. Okay, and I'm saying that this is a heuristic, so soundness is guaranteed by the search algorithm. So you can do anything you want in terms of this graph. So if you think that I missed something in my relaxed plan extraction, don't yell at me. It's okay. So this is a very important liberating laziness factor. Another thing that you can do using planning graphs, which actually a lot of these planners use, is the actions that come into the planning graph structure are the only ones that are actually reachable in any state. I mean, so if you consider the planning graph structure and look at the last level where all the action, the last level of the action, and a specific action that you are interested in, A95, doesn't appear in that last level. I can guarantee you that starting from your initial state, you would never reach a real world state where A95 would ever be applicable. Which basically means, as far as you're concerned, for this problem, A95 doesn't exist. Throw it out. And remember that there are more actions, more branching. And so you can actually cut down the branching factor by saying that I'll only look at the actions that appear in the final level of the planning graph. Now, if you do this, you don't lose completeness. Okay, but it's planning competition. Suppose you're in planning competition. Who cares whether you're complete or not? You know, as long as you actually get done faster than the other guy, you get prize. Okay? So one idea would be to say, I don't want to be complete. I just want to reduce my branching factor, and somehow, you know, that gives me a huge advantage. So one idea is, rather than consider the last set of actions in the planning graph which has been grown up to level up, if you do that, you don't lose completeness at all. Instead, I would say only consider the actions at the level at which the top level goals come in. So I'm being lazy with respect to computation of planning graph. So I only went up to the place where the top level goals come in, and I look at those actions. I just look at them, and I only use them in my branching. If you do this, you have even fewer branching actions, branching possibilities, but you are no longer guaranteed to be complete. But who knows? I mean, you know, who cares during the competition? If you do give a plan out, people are happy. Okay. You can be even more daring and say, look, I will just take I will be lazy. I will take my graph only up to the first level where the top level goals come in. And then I will compute the relaxed plan on this graph, which are the action, and I'll only focus on the actions that appear in that relaxed plan. Forget about the rest of the planning graph. That's pretty daring, you know, living on the edge. But on the other hand, it reduces the branching factor even more. You know, clearly it's incomplete. You know, people will turn in graves if they are interested in completeness and they're doing this. And yet, you know, come to most of these planners who are using relaxed plan heuristics are doing this. And in fact, I think FF's helpful action heuristic is very close to what I just described at the end. Okay? But notice that when you're doing this, you do lose completeness. It still doesn't affect your soundness. And as I as I said, the worst thing that can happen to you is to enter a planner into the competition which is unsound. Never do that. Okay. Incomplete, okay, and slow, everybody can live with it. Okay. So that's other ways of using the planning graph data structure. What I want to do next is to take into account something that I ignored until now, which is negative interaction. Okay. In the entire way I computed the planning graph data structure, I have ignored the negative interactions between the actions, and so it still was useful, and we could do relaxed plans on top of it. And you know, the question is, can you do some of these negative? Can you take some of the negative interactions into account? Okay. Turns out that this what you could wind up doing is you could mark subsets of propositions and subsets of actions which can't live together. And the technical way to say people can't live together is that they're mutually exclusive. Okay? And if you can somehow mark these things which can't live together, and furthermore, if there is a cheap way in which you can compute this, you know, we can't live together information on the planning graph, that can be used to actually capture the negative interactions in the planning graph. Okay? And from the graph plan terminology, that's corresponding to mutual exclusion population. Okay? And we'll look at how that actually winds up being useful in the next couple of slides. Okay, so it's the same exact planning graph again, and this time there are also these ugly arcs, and those are essentially saying that if there is an arc between, let's say, sample and soil, and sample the soil at alpha and drive from alpha to beta, and there is an arc between both of them, that's because they can't live together. You can't do those two actions together. Why? Because for one, you need to be at that place. The other is trying to take you out of that place. So you can't live together. This is actually static interference. Okay, so people don't need to know about graph plan to realize that two actions cannot be done together because they're conflicting. Because, you know, two actions can't be done together if one's preconditions are violated by the other guy's effect. Simple. Okay? What's nice is that this mutual exclusion information actually can be propagated forward in the planning graph structure. So the idea would be that, you know, your parent, your father and my father can't get along well, you know, and which basically probably might mean that you and I should not be seen together. Okay, in the planning graph terminology, these two actions cannot get along well, and this action is the only action which makes a proposition P true, and this action is the only action which makes Q true in the next level, then P and Q cannot really be present in the same state, because these two actions can never be done together. Now, this is the propagation of mutual exclusion information on the planning graph, and all we are doing is computing the binary mutexes, 2RE can't live together information. And it can be done in essentially square time on top of the planning graph. Now, if you have that information, you can actually improve your set level heuristics. Okay? You can say, not only am I interested in the first level where a certain set of conditions are coming into the planning graph, but I'm interested in the first level where they come in and they can get along. It's not enough to just stand around. You need to be not mutually exclusive. And it turns out that just as in the planning graph data structure, once something comes in, it will continue to stay. If an action comes in at level 1, it will be there through 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. If a proposition comes in level 5, it will be there in 5, 6, 7, etc. If a mutual exclusion goes away at level 7, it will never ever come back in. Okay, that's the thing about mutual exclusion. The point is, if it's not, if two things are not mutually exclusive in level 7, that means there exists at least one way of making the first one and one way of making the second one such that both can be done. Which means if you go to the 8th level, you still have those two plans and do nothing. And that will still make these two non-mutual. So mutual exclusion, once it goes away, it will never come back in between the same set of preconditions. So that's a piece of information that you can use in saying that my heuristic value now is the first level at which the set of goals that I'm interested in come into the planning graph proposition list, and no pair of them are mutually exclusive. Okay. And so in this particular example, so I have these two mutually exclusive, and so I also have, because of those guys' mutual exclusiveness, these two are mutually exclusive by propagation. Now, however, by the time I come to this level, they are no longer mutually exclusive because there are alternate ways of generating those propositions. And so the set level for, I guess what we are looking at in this case is, let's see. Okay, so the set level, the first level at which at B and have soil are true, at B and have soil are true and are not mutually exclusive is number two. Although they're actually present in this level. Okay, so they're present in this level, but they're mutually exclusive. Okay, so you have to continue until they don't become mutually exclusive. Okay. There are some tricks like this in terms of using, by doing this, you're actually getting a better information about how costly it is to compute this set of goals. Okay. Somebody was asking about max versus set level heuristic. This is a case where max and set level are going to be different. Okay, so max essentially is saying the maximum of the levels at which individual goals come into the planning graph, and set level is now saying the first level at which all of them come in and they are not mutually exclusive. And set level can be infinite while max is finite. Okay, so it can be as different as that. Okay, so if you take these negative interactions, you have a more informed heuristic because this is closer to the true value of the, you know, reaching these literals from the current state. And so you could have faster, so you have more informed heuristic, and so you can have more accurate search. I would not go into details here, but the paper actually that I had, the survey paper actually tries to argue that a more recent planner, FF Downward, which I think it's called FF Downward, right? The one that Malte did, and he got a nice prize last time. You can see what it is doing as a way of taking negative interactions into account. In terms of one of the things he does is basically convert a domain which has Boolean fluents into a domain which has multi-array fluents. The moment you have multi-array fluents, you have taken into account some negative interaction information because you know that a fluent can only have one of these values, okay? Whereas in the binary version, you will wind up having separate variable for each of them. So in fact, I think generally the notion of using negative interactions to improve plans hasn't been tried as much at the competition level planners. One exception, however, is people who did, so I've been talking all this while about progression planners, okay? Now, that's partly because many of the planners these days that are entering the competition are progression planners. But there are all sorts of other planners. Regression, which starts from the back, the goal and goes backwards, is another planner. And in fact, upfront people would think that regression planners are likely to be faster for two reasons, not even one. One is because there is lower branching factor. If you know what your goals are, there are only so many actions that are relevant to your goal, action goal, point one. And point two is even if you are into planning graph heuristics, right? The way the planning graph heuristics work for progression planners is mind-bogglingly seemingly inefficient, okay? For every state on the fringe, you have to compute a planning graph from that state on the fringe. Use the relaxed plan from that planning graph. Count the actions in that. That would be the heuristic value for that. A second planning graph for the second guy. A third planning graph for the third guy. This is part of the reason why many of the progression search planners use beam search, so that you don't have to compute these millions of planning graphs. Okay? Now, if you're doing regression search, on the other hand, the entire planning graph structure depends on the state at which you start from. In regression, the initial state is constant. In progression, the initial state is kind of going forward. Okay? In regression, the initial state is constant, and you're coming from the goal state towards the initial state. So, in principle, you just need one planning graph. Actually, not just in principle. In fact, you only need one planning graph, okay? And you can use that planning graph to compute heuristics at any level of the regression graph. So it's a huge advantage, seemingly. And what is surprising is history as of 1999 to now tells us that even though it's seeming advantage, it actually doesn't work well in practice. And there are reasons as to why it doesn't work well in practice are quite interesting. One of which is that negative interaction information is quite critical for regression. Because when you're doing regression, it turns out that you are searching not in the space of world states, but in the space of sets of world states. In essence, you're searching in the space of formulae. And many of these formulae could be inconsistent. That means you have something that you think corresponds to a set of world states, except that the set is empty. And you could spend a lot of time expanding it, and the best way you can waste your life in search is to make dead men have children and grandchildren. You know, a dead node should be killed as soon as you can figure that out. And you know, if you don't have that negative interaction information, you would not know this, and you'll keep going forward. And that's one very important reason why, you know, if you don't use the negative interactions, regression planners will die right away. And we have done in the beginning, in fact, in the beginning of this drive towards reachability heuristics, people have tried regression planners. Geffner has done work on, Bonnet and Geffner has done work on HSP regression called HSPR planner. And for the same reasons, that is, you could just do one reachability analysis. We did something called Alt-Alt, both of which are regression planners. And in both these cases, actually, especially in the Alt-Alt case, we actually considered putting the relaxed plan, which takes positive interactions into account, and take that number and add to it a penalty which is derived from the negative interaction. Okay? And so you can actually adjust relaxed plan. So this is an idea that I want you to kind of keep in mind. It's a bigger idea. You can start with a relaxed plan which ignores all the negative interactions and penalize it for the negative interactions it missed. And the penalty factor is computed qualitatively based on the negative interaction. Again, remember that I'm not being particularly formal about am I capturing all the negative interactions, etc. I need to be, because it's heuristic information. If I'm wrong, I'll take more time. If I'm right, you know, I'll get done much faster. Okay? Yes, sir. What? Yes, they have done that. In fact, there's one, the Greek, what's his name, Refanidis and co. have done this. They don't do any better. In fact, there's even more interesting stuff they have done where they try to learn when is it what during the same problem iteration, you know, try to decide whether to go forward now or backward now, and forward now or backward now. They have done that, but none of them did any faster than just going forward until now, which is kind of really depressing for some of the old timers because, you know, there's so much more interesting planning algorithms. You know, it's like whatever that the Aldous Huxley's version applied to the planning, I guess, you know. The beautiful planning algorithms biting the dust because of the competition. You know, I think there's a version of that it's saying, the beautiful theory killed by an ugly experiment or something. You know, you can go and look it up. So that's what is happening in terms of heuristic control is very important. If not, you cannot look at all these beautiful planning algorithms which make a lot more sense. You know, for example, something which I haven't even got to, and we have already been going on for, 1 hour now, is partial order planning, which is we are doing planning, and if you are searching for plans, people don't necessarily think in terms of states and going from one state to other. They think in terms of, I have this plan, I need to do something else. Oh, okay, where can I insert actions for what else I have to do into the plan that I currently have? So if you're searching for plans, search in the space of plans. That seems like a no-brainer. And yet, and there are beautiful algorithms on that, and I'll say a little about it, but the reason you don't, you know, especially looking at the young people here, you probably never heard of them because they're not doing well in the competition. Okay? It turns out that they can be made to do well, at least to some extent, using the same ideas. But, you know, again, as to whether you can beat the state-of-the-art progression planner or not is an important issue. Okay? I think competitions are important in that sense. I'm not being bitter as an old man. It's just that I think and heuristic information is important because that's how the planners are doing well ultimately. So in this case, what we wind up doing in Alt-Alt was to take the length of the relaxed plan and add to it a penalty factor which corresponds to the maximally interacting pair of literals. Now, the interaction between the pair of literals PQ, delta of PQ, is defined in the following way. It's the level at which P and Q appear together first without having mutual exclusion between them, minus the maximum of the levels at which any of them appear in. Now you notice that if they have no negative interactions, that number would be zero. That's exactly why max and level heuristics were exactly one and the same in the beginning. But the moment you start having negative interactions taken into account, this number can be as large as you want. In fact, it can be infinite. Okay, that means they don't ever actually become non-mutex in the planning graph at all. And what we are doing is, we are adding that penalty factor to this part which is only taking into account the positive interactions and the causality. And that increases the cost of that set. For right reasons, because they actually look as if they get along, but they don't get along well. And in AltAlt, which is a regression planner, this makes huge difference. In fact, the main heuristic that it uses is this thing called adjusted sum heuristic, which can be seen as this exact plan plus this negative interaction penalty. As far as I know, no progression planners currently do that. There are variations of, I mean, as I said earlier, you could think of downward using some negative interaction information, but not exactly this way. In general, taking more negative interaction information into account in the right way, such that you can actually, is something that I think seems like a good open issue. Okay. However, because we are talking about heuristics, you could do too much and wind up losing because you spend too much time computing the heuristic and you don't recoup that information. So if you want to try this, you actually need to write planners and play with them. Okay. I don't know that I need to go into the regression. This example, I think I more or less described this. The one thing that I do want to say, so I sort of told you that you can use planning graph heuristics for progression search until now. I also, in passing just now, said you could use it for regression search because they're not that different really. The only important piece that you want to know is that you need negative interaction information. Otherwise, you know, you could still live, but you live pretty poorly because the search direction is pretty bad. Okay, so we did, it turns out that you can actually use the same kind of idea for planned space search, okay? In fact, I can spend like probably too much time just explaining what is planned space search to some of you guys because maybe, you know, not everybody is aware of it. But let me just say quickly that ultimately what happens in the planned space search in the partial order planner is you start with a null plan, which is essentially a dummy action corresponding to the initial state, a dummy action corresponding to the end of the plan, and you keep putting more actions into this plan and ordering between them, okay, until some termination condition is satisfied. The termination condition normally is that for every goal, there exists some action which supports that goal, such that once it gives that goal and before the place where it is needed, nobody kills it, okay? And there are these data structures called causal links that you keep track of to make sure that once you commit, nobody kills you between the two places, okay? So, and the way the planning, the partial plans are refined is either by adding a new step into the null plan, into the current partial plan, or taking conflicts between the existing steps. If there is a step which is parallel to two other steps and there's a causal link, causal commitment from this step to that step, and, you know, there is a conflict, you try to get the bad guy out by either putting it out of this, by putting it after or before. Okay? In fact, you can also, depending on the kind of action representation you use, if you have conditional effects, for example, you can stare down this bad guy and say, don't give that bad effect. Okay, so for example, the guy, so if you have a causal link from here to here, it says P, and there's an action which says, if you give me Q, I will give you not P. So you can stare down this guy and say, you shall not get Q, okay, and I will make sure that you will not get Q, that way you would not say not P. And so not Q now becomes an extra sub-goal that needs to be satisfied right before this action. So that's called confrontation. And, you know, partial order planning is a treasure trove of beautiful terminological things. So just for that, you should read partial order planning. And then one day you may be even reading hierarchical task network planning, which is even more interesting terminology. But the point is you're searching in the space of partial plans. Now it turns out that you can actually use these same kinds of reachability information to improve performance of those kinds of planners too. Not to the level where they would be killing everybody in the competition, but with respect to other partial order planners, you can do quite well. So, for example, one thing you could do is you could consider, if you ignore negative interactions, and if you have a partial plan, let's say, such that different steps in this plan wind up requiring different preconditions, okay? So I would need G1 at step 15, G5 at step 3, and G4 at step 1, okay? If there are no negative interactions, that means I can actually make them all true before the very first step and then persist them. If I'm ignoring negative interactions, that's a reasonable thing to do. So what I could wind up doing is take the union of the open conditions in the partial plan. These are the conditions that are not supported by causal links. And act as if it's a state. And once you think it's a state, you can use all your fun stuff, such as, you know, planning graph heuristics. And furthermore, actually, it turns out that there's another way you can use the planning graph heuristics in this context. Notice that if you're doing negative interaction propagation, you might wind up finding that certain things are actually mutually exclusive sworn enemies, even though they don't look like that. So P and not P, you know that they're sworn enemies. It could also be shown that there are some in some domains, based on the mutual exclusion propagation, you might find that P and Q are perpetually mutually exclusive. Okay? That's because you propagated the mutex information on the planning graph all the way up to the level of condition, and any mutexes that are left at the level of, they are forever. They're not going to change ever. Okay? Now, so if P and Q are mutex that way, then you can actually use that information to say that even though this guy, so there is a causal link from here to here saying P, and this guy gives Q, looks as if they're happy, but you know better. You know that P and Q are sworn enemies because of your mutual exclusion analysis, and you say, hey, get out of this place, you know, out here, out there. By doing this, you essentially deal with an interaction much earlier than you would have done, which is good. If you're going to die, die faster, right? I mean, that's the whole point of search. I mean, if you're going to fail, fail first, okay? And so if there's going to be an interaction, the earlier you can detect it, the better off you are. And it turns out that's also another useful way in which the same analysis winds up being helpful for partial data planners. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is, I think we spent enough time on deterministic classical planners. I want to do a few things for the next, 20 minutes in terms of keeping the deterministic model still, but I want to add two extra things in terms of the planning model. One is I want to have costs for action. That's my first thing. It seems like a very reasonable thing. And it drives me up the wall that we still think that optimal means the number of actions. So for example, there is, you know, SAT plan won the optimal planning track, couple of years back. It's bogus. And don't tell this to Henry, but it's bogus because essentially SAT plan can only compute optimum if optimum is defined in terms of the number of actions. It's very reasonable to define optimum in terms of the total cost. So if each action has a different non-uniform cost, right? And then you can wind up saying that there is a 15 action plan which is only 20 units long, 20 units costly, compared to a 3 action plan which is 3,000 units costly. And the step optimal plan is no longer optimal with respect to cost. Okay? As a community, we haven't paid too much attention to cost of the action. And, you know, we can always say, well, if you do A star search, you can always do it. And I'll at least want to show you that if you're doing A-star search and this kind of graph plan-based heuristics, how do you propagate cost? Okay. The kind of approach that SAT plan or graph plan does not actually extend to cost-sensitive optimal planning, because the first place, the way the SAT plan works, to those of you who understand this, is you look for the smallest plan in level, I mean, if you look to see whether there's a plan in level K, and if you find it, you stop. If not, you go to K plus 1. If not, you go to K plus 2. What I'm saying is you don't necessarily know that the first plan you find is actually optimal. It's pretty darn tricky to make SAT plan actually find the cost optimal plan. So the cost optimal plans that you can find right now are heuristic based, surprisingly enough. Okay? And I think, and I am trying to brainwash you just before coffee break, I think that if the 2004 optimal planning track was run taking into account a cost-based optimality metric rather than telling people that you can decide what you're optimal with respect to, which I think is like, you know, AI 101. You don't get to decide your performance metric. Right? If we decide our performance metric, we're all done. In fact, we're done yesterday. So if you do that, then you probably heuristic-based cost-based kernels are the only ones that actually exist right now. Okay. So having said that, now I want you to think about what that we have talked about till now becomes costlier or harder because you take action costs into account. So this is the new and spiffy rover with cost. The same rover domain, except now actions have been given cost. Ignore the stuff in square brackets for now. That's supposed to be action duration. We won't talk about it for right now. Okay. So the dollars are the cost. So different actions have different costs. Okay? So the question then is, what happens if you have cost propagation in the planning graph? More or less everything remains same, except now you have the following issue, which is, let's ask for the first simplest question. Where do you stop propagating the planning graph? I mean, where do you stop computing the planning graph? Previously, for the so if all actions have the uniform cost, then I can say stop as soon as all the goals, as soon as, for example, all the goals come in. Okay, that's a cheap thing to do. Or go all the way to level off, which is between node two, between two consecutive propositional lists, nothing has changed. Now, if you have action cost into account, then you have to say between two propositional lists, no cost information has changed too. Not only are you interested in whether the proposition lists are the same, but whether their costs are also same. What's more interesting is, based on what I just told you earlier, so the idea of cost propagation is, the obvious idea would be that if this is 30 units costly and it's supporting this particular proposition here, then if you were to make this true using this action, it would be 30 units costly too, right? And so if there are multiple supporters to somebody, then it's very reasonable. I think all of you would agree with me that you should take min of those costs. That's the only sane thing to do. Why would you take the costlier one? Okay. And then the trickier issue, of course, is if you have an action which has five preconditions, each of them have different costs. What is the cost of the preconditions for that action? Is it the sum of all the preconditions? Is it the max of the cost of the preconditions? Is it the, sum or max, or what else is there? That's basically, those are two things to try. Or you could consider, for example, computing them indirectly using some sort of a lax plan. Okay? And a third issue that I want to bring up in terms of cost is something that's obvious, is cost can reduce. In fact, a cost associated with a literal is guaranteed to monotonically reduce. I mean, it's going to be non-increasing. It's going to be non-increasing. Because if you could make something true by this level using $30, you can still do that same thing true by this level using $30. Just don't do anything in this level. Okay? But then there may be a cheaper way of doing it. That's the interesting part about cost-sensitive planning. That's why I said there could be a three-action plan which is actually costlier than a five-action plan. I mean, grad students definitely know this. I mean, if you keep taking multiple hop flights, oftentimes that's cheaper than just taking one nonstop flight from one end to other. So even if you forget about durations, if you think each flight is an action, you clearly have, smaller number of actions corresponding to a larger cost. Okay. So from the point of view of actually doing the planning graph computation here, the issues are, when do you stop? So as I said, the advantage, of course, is I don't need to know the right answer. I just want to bring up that there's complexities here, and then I'll pick something. And then if I'm wrong, my planner won't do as well in search. But again, I think it's nice to be lazy. I mean, nice to have the flexibility to be lazy. And I think by concentrating on your research on the heuristics, you get to be doing that, okay? So one idea is just to say, for example, go all the way to the first level where the top level goals come into the planning graph and stop. That's the laziest thing you can do. Or I can say I'll be a little less lazy than that. I'll go up to that level and go k more level. That would be k look ahead. The larger that k, the more informed your cost propagate, the final propagated cost would be. Okay? And we have tried, I think people who looked at this kind of algorithms have tried different values of k, and obviously depending upon the benchmark, you know, you actually can get by with smaller values of k. K equal to 1 and 2 could be quite good. Okay? The other thing is, so this is basically terminating. You can either just completely ignore look ahead, or you can do infinite look ahead where cost stop changing, or just do k look ahead where you go k number of extra steps. And then, yes, sir. Yes, that's a good idea. In fact, there is a connection of that when you expand the planning graph for temporal actions, you wind up doing something like that. Okay, but nobody has done it exactly. In fact, one way of dealing with time is to ignore time and think of time as cost. And that would be opposite of what you're saying. That is, act as if time, the numbers 30, etc., are actually time units. And I can still make my airplane examples with time. You know, non-stop flights come faster, but they're costing, right? So, but your idea is interesting too, which is actually, I think the opposite has been tried too. We'll talk a little bit offline. But it definitely will be tried for time. Yes, sir. Well, I guess the interesting, let me see, so the question is, when can you ignore time and act as if it is cost? It's a complex question. I'll try to think over the break when he's talking and then get back to you at the end. I mean, I think I have lots of answers, but by the time I'm all done, I'll probably be coffee time, so I'll get back to you. Okay. Now, the other interesting thing is if you do have cost information, you can change the relaxed plan extraction to take cost into account. Remember there was an old slide where I put a green line at the bottom and said the greedy way you actually extract the relaxed plan, that greediness can be biased to take different types of information. So you can be greedy and be biased to take cost information into account. So for example, you know, all the relaxed plan extraction says is if you have a goal to support, pick an action at this level, then its preconditions will come in the next level, then pick actions to support them, and so on. Now, the way you pick that action is up to you. And I would say if there are five guys trying to support me, and one guy says 30 units cost, another guy says 15, another guy says 0, another guy says lower, etc., and then I pick the action which has the lowest propagated cost. Lowest propagated cost, not the action cost itself, but really you want the propagated cost because an action by itself is $30, but it has preconditions whose cost is much higher. Okay? So you pick the supporters which have the lowest propagated cost and use that as the greedy heuristic to extract the relaxed plan. Okay? And if you do that, the other thing that actually you always do, even in the previous relaxed plans, is if you have three goals and you picked an action for supporting one goal, then once that action is in, you may as well reuse it to support another goal too. Because once you pay for that action, it's there. And if it's giving P as well as Q, so this is an interesting thing from the cost point of view. It may well be that a particular action is, if you only have G1 or G2, this action is too costly for either one of them separately. But G1, G2, this is the best action. You could do that. You can take that into account in, extracting the relaxed plan. And the more of that you do, the better your cost-based heuristic is going to be. Okay. But one of the nice things, even at this level, you can see is I haven't changed. This picture looks just as ugly as before. It's again a planning graph. And the only thing is we now have cost information. And you're taking the cost information in computing the relaxed plan. Okay. Um, let's see, I have 5 minutes and I'll at least introduce the next level, and then hopefully when I get back, when we come back from coffee break, Dan would actually start talking about the partial non-deterministic and stochastic planning. And when my time comes to wrap up, I will say a few more things about partial satisfaction planning. Okay, so let me at least introduce the problem. So once you have costs, right, I can extend my planning problem even more and say, look, I don't need to make all goals true. Normal planning problems say you've been given a bunch of goals and you must satisfy all the goals. And simplest planning problem says find the plan that has the least number of actions. Cost-based planning problem says find the plan that has the lowest cost. But all of them have to support all the goals. Okay, now I say each goal has a utility. So you do this goal, you get a number, you know, dollars. Okay, that's the kind of thing we like. And each action has a cost. Okay, now what's the optimal plan? Optimal plan may not even actually wind up supporting all the goals. Okay, so finding the subset of goals, one way of thinking about it is essentially you're trying to find the subset of goals that you should be focusing on such that your net benefit, which is the total utility of the goals you achieved minus the total cost of the action you used to achieve these goals, winds up being maximized. Now, the moment you start talking about it, you have a question. Yes, sir. Oh, no, I haven't even actually looked at this. Let me see. Did it change on me? Oh, no, yeah, it did not change. Okay. Let me talk about that. Okay. So first, there's this notion of, general notion of goals have utilities, actions have costs, and you can then start talking about finding optimal plans with respect to it. Okay. Now, so I don't even know. This is something that we did. So there are two issues. I'll answer this, but in a kind of my own way. So there are, the moment you start having costs as well as utilities for the existing, so one of the interesting things is the costs for the ways of computing plans for different goals might wind up having interactions. So it's $100 to do goal one, $100 to do goal two separately, cost. But if you want to do goal one and goal two, it's $102. I mean, this is the entire way grocery stores make us fat. You know, you get two things, it's only nickel difference. So you get two of them instead of one. Okay? So there is basically interactions between the costs of achieving goals. There can also be interactions between the utilities of goals. Okay? I have basically not told you, I mean, goal one, so left shoe, just having left shoe, you know, if you're going to do this, left shoe is not particularly bad, so it's like $1 utility, okay? Right shoe by itself, $1 utility. But left and right shoe is, using the Visa commercial, priceless. It's much better than any one shoe, okay? So here you have a positive thing, positive interaction between the utility. Okay, so the nice thing is in this kind of a problem, you'll wind up having to consider the cost interactions as well as the goal interactions, and you need to do this at the heuristic level so that you know which direction to go such that the more optimal plan is likely to be there. Now, the best way to solve these problems, probably optimally, is to model them as deterministic Markovization processes. Okay. Unfortunately, they don't scale. They just don't scale. We have done it. You can do it again, but they just don't scale. Okay? So what we are winding up doing is trying to see whether the heuristic search ideas that we have been looking at, the reachability heuristic, can we co-opt them such that they'll help us in this. Okay? In the 3 minutes that I have, what happened to my nice slide? There we go. I want to give you one idea. I want to plant one idea in your brain, and then you can figure this out over the coffee break, and then we'll talk about it towards the end of the day after Dan is done. If you just have cost interactions, this is something that you can understand very easily. If you only have cost interactions, I suggest that if you have n goals, you can find, so goals have utilities, actions have costs, but I'll assume that the utilities between goals are independent. That means if your G1 is $10 good, G2 is $5 good, G1, G2, $15 good. Independence for utilities means summative. Okay? So you ignore the utilities between, so there are no interactions in terms of utilities for the goals. So the one way you can solve the optimal net benefit problem, dumb way, may always understand the dumb way first, is find every subset of the end goals. For each subset of the end goals, find the cost optimal plan, which you already know, because you can use graph plan heuristics to get the cost direction. And whichever winds up, and for each of them you have the cost optimal plan, so you know the cost of that optimal cost plan, and then the utility minus cost is the best net benefit for that subset, and whichever winds up giving the best net benefit, that's your optimal plan. Great idea, dumb idea. And then you start from there and say, what can I do to not make this selection, not do backtracking all the subsets. One idea is to be greedy and select upfront the subset of goals that you're going to focus on and say, I shall stick to my selection. Okay? So now what I can do is I can basically use the planning graph heuristic and idea to figure out which subset of goals is likely to be the optimal subset. Only likely. I may be wrong, but you know, if I'm right, by doing this analysis, I'm likely to be closer to the optimal. So to do this, all you need to do is the following. Start with the end goals, okay? And do the cost analysis, the cost propagation. Do one planning graph and do the cost propagation. For each of the end goals, you know the best cost according to the graph plan propagation, okay, individually. And for each of the end goals, you know the individual utility. Individual utility minus individual cost is the individual net benefit for each of those goals. If you must pick one goal, it doesn't take a PhD to figure out that you pick the one which has the best net benefit. So I pick that goal and I commit to it now. Okay, now I have to pick the second goal. The only interesting point is that the second goal which had the highest net benefit previously may not be the second goal to add to the first goal you picked. Why? Because there are cost interactions. If you are already doing G1, some of the same actions also support G2. So you don't have to double count the cost for those actions. So what I wind up doing is, having picked the goal that I'm going to pick, I have the relaxed plan for that goal. The actions in that relaxed plan, I ignore their cost now. They don't cost me anymore. So I now recompute the relaxed plan for each of the N-1 goals, acting as if those actions are zero cost. And now compute the net benefit. This is called the residual net benefit for the second goal. And pick the second goal that has the best residual net benefit. Pick the third goal which has the best residual net benefit. When do you stop? You stop when residual net benefit starts becoming negative. That means, so you don't have to, sometimes, you know, as you keep adding goals, it's the cost minus, the utility minus cost is actually winding up to haunt you. It's a very simple idea. I'll get to it in a minute. It's a very simple idea. It's like, you know, more or less just built on everything that we just said. Okay, and you can write up a little program to do this. It works. Actually, doing this simple residual relaxed plan idea to pick the subset of goals. And once you pick the subset of goals, it's just classical planning. I mean, cost-sensitive classical planning. And you do that separately. And it definitely improves the quality. So if you draw this graph of how much time I have to spend to reach the quality, okay, you can reach a particular quality net benefit of the plan much faster if you use this. And this is just the beginning. You can do more variations on this. Yes, sir. That's a very good point. So, I agree. So the point that he's making is G1 winds up having a propagated cost of one unit, and that winds up being the G1 is what you're going to pick. I mean, propagated cost 30 units, and that winds up being the first goal you pick. But you can get the 30 unit cost either by taking this path or this path or this path, and which path is the best depends on what other goals you're going to pick. I agree. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just pick one of them, and with respect to my commitment that I have there, I try to improve, pick the next goal. If you want to be optimal, you have to consider the interactions. You have to consider for each of these plans, if I were to pick this plan for this goal, would I have had a better net benefit for the next goal? Okay. In fact, there's a variation of this particular idea which we tried, where you don't commit so fast to the first goal. In fact, a variation of your idea is, suppose G1 is 30 units, G1's net benefit is, you know, let's say 30 units, but then there's a G2 whose net benefit is close enough. Okay. Rather than commit, I might consider both of them and parallelly try to see what is the best that I can do in terms of the residual net benefit that I add in. And this winds up doing better. Again, I'm doing it all in a heuristic. You know, you can spend more time, and in fact, you should be my guest to spend more time and see if you can beat, you know, a guy who is lazier. It's not upfront obvious. Yes, sir.
You have an intuition about, one of the things you didn't really mention is that this is kind of, every time you add a new goal, it's like a gamble. And my intuition is that the chance that you'll fail to find any plan before the time runs out goes up. As you add each goal, there's a higher and higher chance that you just fail.
No, see, this particular version I showed you, I am actually picking the set of sub-goals that I'm going to, so if I have n goals, I'm going to decide which subset of goals I'm going to concentrate on. This analysis takes very little time. It's not planning. Remember, we're actually doing it on the relaxed planning graph.
You're not committing to achieving the full subset.
No, once I pick that subset, I'm going to commit. Once I pick that subset, I'm going to commit.
Right, so when you get a bigger subset, isn't there a chance that you'll just fail, that you'll time out?
Yes, so in fact, There are slides here. There is a negative interaction. You should actually take negative interactions between goals into account. We have done that. There is, in fact, a couple of... Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to call it just discounting. As you add a goal, you say not the net benefit, but the net benefit times some, you know...
Yeah, no, but I think discounting doesn't make as much sense. I mean, because I still need to pick... remember, this is sort of a pre-processing step. The only bad thing I could do is two ways I could go wrong. You know, I picked up this subset thinking this is the best subset to concentrate on, and my cost propagation, which makes lots of, you know, like for example, adding up the precondition cost, which is an independence assumption, was off, and so in fact, the real net optimal net benefit is far away from this. Okay. The other is the subset I picked, since I ignored all the negative interactions, actually it can't even be achieved. Okay, and the second actually is somewhat easy to handle, because I already talked to you about how to deal with negative, you know, mutual exclusion information. One of the things that I didn't spend time in the talk today is what would be mutual exclusion for cost-sensitive planning graph. Think about that. Okay, if you have mutual exclusion information on top of cost-sensitive planning graph, how would your propagation of cost differ? It's actually easy enough to do, but it's slightly, tricky. Okay, so that's something. If you do that, then you wind up taking negative interactions into account while propagating the cost. That's a reasonable thing to do. And if you do that, then you're more likely to have picked the right subset. And notice that I'm doing this very wishy-washy, you know, I'm more likely to pick better subset, less likely to pick. I get to be that because I'm doing this at the heuristic level. Okay, I will never be the laughing stock of you guys, because when I give you a plan, it will work, you know, and I never guarantee probable optimality, so I don't take part in the, you know, optimal track, but those guys stop at the second problem anyway, most of the time, okay. Probable optimality is a dream. It's nice to have proofs, but, you know, they don't scale. And so I think I'm kind of brainwashing you into thinking that heuristics are good. Admissibility is a good thing to think about. One of the nice open problems is to how to get powerful admissible heuristics. The most powerful admissible heuristic I've told you till now is very bad, which is basically set level is a admissible heuristic. If you add memos on top of set level, mutual exclusions and memos on top of set level, that will still be admissible. That's not powerful enough. So the cost-benefit ratio for admissible heuristics isn't all that high. We'll stop here. We'll get back after the coffee break, and then we'll change gears for stochastic planning, and then we'll come back and end it. Thank you.
Bounded rationality.
Yeah, but the bounded part is
that if you have a time bound, you just